My perspective on science derives from my identity. I was born to the world as a Palestinian refugee. My parents are refugees. Thinking about science, thinking about a PhD, thinking about the cool work that I get to do today was not part of my childhood. You always hear the story that, oh, when I was a kid, I was deconstructing a motor of my game and then reconnected it, and I knew I wanted to be an engineer. I was not doing that. I think my whole trajectory, which we will get into, is shocking even to my parents.
Welcome to the Baker Lab Podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, a professor here with a large lab where research happens every day. I've seen firsthand how science depends on more than just ideas and experiments. It's really about the people who make it all happen. Each episode, you'll hear from one of the researchers in my lab here at the Institute for Protein Design. They are designing proteins to solve a very wide range of the problems currently facing humanity. And the areas range from biology and chemistry to physics and AI. And their journeys are as diverse as science itself. And these journeys are really important. They prove that there are many ways of becoming and being a scientist.
In this first episode, you'll be hearing from Mohamed Abdi, who joined David's lab in 2021. His research here explores how cells communicate, and as you'll hear later on in our conversation, he's whispering to them in new ways.
I've had the privilege of working with many amazing scientists, but Mohamed's life story is one I'll never forget. As you'll soon discover, he's persevered through tough times to become a creative and curious researcher.
Mohamed is quick to point out that he didn't journey into science alone. His family helped him at critical moments, and he found friends in various labs that he could lean on. His inspiring story was even noticed by President Barack Obama. I began our conversation with Mohamed by asking him to share a little more about his parents.
So both of my parents were born and grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and both of them could not finish their education. So both of them did not finish their high school education. That means that the resources that was available to them, the life choices that they had to make was restricted by that, right? And it's not out of choice. It's not that they did not want to do it. They just could not do it. Despite that, or maybe because of that, they really, really, really valued education. They thought of it as a way to escape the destiny that they had to go through.
Tell me about what school was like for you with that as the backdrop.
My parents were working in the United Arab Emirates in a city called Abu Dhabi. And that's where I grew up and I spent most of my childhood until we immigrated to the US when I was 17 years old. So there is two halves of my life. There's the half before coming to the US and the half after coming to the US. Very different. And they kind of don't connect together. But I think that's what is very fascinating about how the human story goes. I grew up in Abu Dhabi, which is in the United Arab Emirates, and something that shocks a lot of people is that for kindergarten and elementary school, I went to a Catholic school, which is not what you would think a Palestinian refugee in the United Arab Emirates would be doing. What I would spend my time doing in class is writing out signs to organize protests that will happen during the lunch. And this is, mind you, like people who are like third grade, fourth grade, and the teachers are probably looking at us and like, what are they doing, right? That's where my mind was oriented. And then science was completely not in the picture. And it's not because I did not want to be a scientist. It's just that I did not know about it. Life for us was more that you go to school, you get good education, you get a job, and that's enough to sustain your family. There was no looking forward beyond that because it was more of a survival step in your life as opposed to a luxury or I guess it is a luxury because at the end of the day, doing science is a luxury that not everybody gets to do.
Let's bridge from that early part of your life to age 17 and on. Can you tell me about that big transformation?
So when I immigrated to the US, I came to California and I was 17. The reason that we immigrated is that my family and I, as refugees, have no passports, no citizenships, and that made our life very difficult. And we wanted to, my parents wanted to enhance our life by giving us the opportunities to be citizens of the United States, where we would have rights, where we would be able to live a normal life. So that was the motivation. It wasn't an educational motivation to come here. So we applied for immigration, and then about 11 years later, our process was approved. It happened when I was 17. It was random. We came to the US, and my parents had jobs back there, so they had to go and work, because otherwise we would have no money. Our life was dependent on my parents working. So it was not sustainable for them to come and stay here. But I wanted to stay here because I wanted to get an education in the United States, knowing that an education in the United States would give me better opportunities in my future. And funny enough, there was pushback from my parents. So they tried to incentivize me because they didn't want to leave me at 17 years old in a new country alone. So they tried to incentivize me, but I was stubborn and I refused to go back. What ended up happening is that if you have limited resources and you come to the United States and you have not prepared your whole life with SATs and all the right AP classes, you have to go to community college. That's the only option you have. And even with community college, at the time that I came here, it was relatively expensive because you had to stay a year and prove your residency to get a discounted amount. And otherwise, it's quite a bit of money. So there was this decision of, do I go to school immediately or do I wait a year until it's more affordable for me to go to school? At the time, and this has happened multiple times during my education, my brother, who's a little bit older than me, has said that whatever it takes for me to get my education, he's willing to do it. So he told me to not worry about the money side and just focus on the education side. So there was a lot of sacrifice that came from my parents and from my siblings and for me to be here. So that experience, I would again say that it was not centered around science yet. I still did not know about scientists, and it was still focused on building a life that would be better than the alternative. That was the whole focus. So it was just a family trying to move into a new country and build a life that is better than what we had.
Wow, that's incredible, especially with the help of your brother too. So you didn't wait with his encouragement. You signed up, even though it was a little more expensive.
Yes.
And you started at community college.
I started in Irvine Valley Community College. Yes.
So let's start there. You are 17. You're in a new country surrounded by new people, and you're taking on community college. What was that like?
I think the biggest thing that I experienced when I came here from an education perspective is that a lot of the education system in Middle Eastern countries is built around the concept of memorization and very little application, if any. What that means is that I was very good at memorizing concepts and I was very good at regurgitating things. But the huge discrepancy that I found when I came here, even at community college, is that the focus is very different. It's not about memorization. It's more about application of concepts and creativity in how you think about them. So it's more open-ended. It's more problem-based. And that created a lot of troubles for me. And I remember this very clearly because when I first came, I did very poorly in my classes because of this shift, because It is a very different mentality to approach science. And that is something that I wish I would have known earlier. I wish that I would have known in high school while taking my biology classes or physics classes or chemistry classes that the goal should not be to get the highest grade. The goal should be to fundamentally understand what you're being taught, to think about it, to explore it, to test its boundaries. So I think that difference in structure of education was shocking, but I think it was also kind of a seed for changing my perspective on what the purpose of education is. So instead of having the goal be getting a degree so a company can hire you and you can have a job, the goal now was, oh, this is actually interesting. There is things here that we don't know, and we are at a place that maybe we can ask questions about things that nobody has attempted before. That seed started building in community college. Granted, I had no idea that a PhD was a thing. I had no idea how you'd go about it until I transferred into UC Irvine. So that's where I did my bachelor's in biomedical engineering. And in one class, a professor came to the class and said, oh, I'm looking for a couple of undergrads to work in my lab as research assistants if you're interested to apply. And I was intrigued by it. So I applied not knowing anything at all about it. And I ended up joining that professor's lab. And I think that's where my journey with science really started. Particularly what they wanted to do is to build microfluidic circuits that can be operated without electricity. And the reasoning is that a lot of the places where a microfluidic diagnostic device would be useful are places in remote areas where electricity might not be available. So the whole goal of the lab was to build these pneumatically controlled microfluidics. And basically what that means is that you can run them based on differences in air pressure. So you can use an air pump and pump an air differential, and that should automate and run this chip. So that was the idea. I was very lucky to be in an environment where I was surrounded by grad students that are very curious. So we would spend a lot of time talking about concepts, about ideas, and that really drew me and intrigued me. Little by little, I was convinced that that's what I wanted to do. And that's how I decided to apply for PhD programs, because I really enjoyed the process of thinking about ideas, coming up with solutions, reading about technologies that are being created every day in science. And there was a lot of excitement there. The recurring theme in my scientific journey so far is that I don't let myself be too committed to one scientific area, because the more you learn about science, the more you learn about different areas, the more you will be fascinated. And you will quickly get to see that the coolest kind of science, and this is starts to relate as to what happens here at the IPD, happens at the intersection of different sciences. So if you are at a place where you have seen multiple kinds of science, multiple approaches to solving problems, and you can start connecting that, that's where great things start to happen. I think going and doing that research there was an important link in the knowledge that I've built over time, where you can now connect these independent knowledge points into something bigger.
All right, so before we move on to the next link in science, which for you was graduate school, mm-hmm. I want to stay at UC Irvine for a minute. I hear you had a pretty memorable commencement. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. I remember one day I was just sitting and the lab was mostly empty. And then I get a phone call that says White House as the caller. And I immediately knew that this is a fake call, as usual. So it was funny. And I did not answer the call. And then later I get an email from the White House saying that they have called and nobody answered and they're trying to reach me. And I called back. And what happened is that it turns out that it was not fake. There was a staffer from the White House telling me that President Barack Obama was coming to UC Irvine to give the commencement speech, and they were looking for stories to share during his speech. And one of the stories they were interested in is mine. So they wanted to ask a bit more about it, but they also very heavily emphasized that they're not guaranteeing anything and I should not be expecting anything. So that was the background. And of course, my parents knew and they were there at the commencement. But then we had no idea what will happen, if he will say something or not say it.
There are people here who know what it means to dream. When Mohammed Abadi was a boy, the suffering he saw in refugee camps in Lebanon didn't drive him into despair. It inspired him to become a doctor. And when he came to America, he discovered a passion for engineering. So here at UC Irvine, he became a biomedical engineer to study the human brain. And Mohammed said, had I never come to the United States, I would have never had the ability to do the work that I'm doing. He's now going to Caltech to keep doing that work.
Wow. It's a big deal to have the president show up at your commencement, but to have him shout you out by name is pretty cool. Did a president notice you as an undergrad?
No.
Yeah, me neither. Now, Mohammed was a little uncomfortable sharing that story because he didn't want to make it seem like he became some hotshot researcher as soon as he started college. He felt new in the United States, and he was about to take on a PhD in biomedical engineering at Caltech, a famously easy subject at a very easy school. He learned a lot in graduate school, but he struggled a lot too. I asked him about that.
Grad school was an amazing time for me. It was a very big change because I came from UC Irvine, which was more of a big traditional college, into Caltech, which tends to be smaller and more focused. And now I was in this position where everything was unknown. There is not a homework, and you know that the answer exists and you have to get to it. And instead, you're asking questions that you don't know the answer to or whether you're going to find an answer to it. On top of that, when I joined Caltech, I joined the lab of Mikhail Shapiro, which at the time was just starting as a professor there. So it was another level of, we are addressing completely unknown things in a completely new lab that has nothing. So it was a lot of building from scratch, a lot of brainstorming ideas, what would be worth going after, what would not be. It was overall very exciting. And I think that's where I built a lot of my confidence in my ability to do science, because as you can imagine from what I've told you earlier, I don't think that I was prepared for this. I did not grow up knowing that I would do a PhD, that I would attempt to become a scientist. So I was not sure if that is something that I am capable of, but I still wanted to try. And this was a question that I had to deal with constantly during my PhD. Throughout the process, I was able to convince myself that despite coming from a different background, despite not preparing for this since I was in high school or even in community college and so on, I was capable of doing these things if I was interested enough in them. And I think I struggled a lot. There was a lot of days that I felt like this is the most difficult thing in the world. This is impossible. But the key was that I was really interested in finding out the answer. I would characterize it as there was enough curiosity that it kept me going, because the end goal, to me at least, was not a paper that you get at the end. Now the end goal was, am I going to discover something new? Am I going to become better at addressing scientific questions? So I would say my PhD was an experience where I convinced myself that I can do it, and there is nothing special. There is no unique qualities or characteristics you have to be endowed by to be a scientist. Anybody can be a scientist if they are interested and curious enough in the questions they are asking.
Let's talk about that struggle in science. I think some people think that science is hard, and so only really capable or really, you know, special people do it. And maybe they think if they're struggling in life or in their education specifically, that must mean they're not cut out for science. Mm-hmm. And at 17, you said you started this new way of learning. That must have been a struggle for you.
So struggle is good. It could be uncomfortable, but I think it's important. And even at the IPD, I try to always put myself in uncomfortable situations where I'm struggling. And at the end of the day, it's almost always a good decision to be there. So there is a lot of struggle. But the thing that really makes it possible, at least from my experience, is struggling with people who would support you. I was very lucky to be among lab mates who were going through the same process as me, but they were also very supportive in terms of acknowledging that sometimes we don't know what we're doing. A lot of times in lab, we'll run experiments and then realize it was all pointless, but that is part of the learning process. And I think being in this community of people where you all acknowledge the shortcomings that you have and you together build towards becoming better scientists, or becoming scientists at that point, because that is the whole process of a PhD, is really what makes it sustainable. Doing it by myself would not have been possible. I learned a lot from others.
Let's jump forward a little bit in the story and talk about where you are now. We are recording this at the Institute for Protein Design, the IPD. Can you talk a bit about your time here?
My story with the IPD is a funny one, mainly because when I finished my PhD, I was hesitant to do a postdoc, and I was more interested in going for an independent fellow position, someplace where I have more autonomy over what I'm doing. But part of that process of writing proposals for these positions, I had an idea that was relevant to what David Baker was working on, and then I decided to just send him an email and ask him a question about whether he thinks that idea is feasible. Of course, if you've met David, you'll know that he responds to emails by the title. So he responded to my email and offered me to come and do an interview at the IPD when I was not asking for it. And it was a very interesting moment for me, because I very clearly did not want to do a postdoc, but at the same time, I did not want to tell him that that was not what I was asking him for. And I thought, oh, like, what could it hurt to come and like meet people and talk to them? So that's how it happened. David did an instinctual decision based on an email I sent, and I decided to go along with the misunderstanding of my email. And I think that was the best decision that I've made. It was the best coincidence that happened, because when I came here, I just fell in love with the culture, with the diversity of the people, where you have people from different backgrounds with different expertise working together to address some of the most challenging problems that we have in the field of protein design, but more broadly in the extended fields of therapeutics or in the field of sustainability and technology building and so on. So that's how I ended up at the IPD.
That's great. Can you tell me what a typical day working here has been like for you? Maybe start in the morning.
So the best part of the day is my bike ride over to here, because I get to bike over the Fremont Bridge, which is a very pretty bridge in Seattle. It's usually a great start for the day. And whenever I end up at work, most of my time is spent talking to people. And the reason is because I think the most valuable experiments or ideas that I explored in this lab came out of these conversations. To me, that makes a lot of sense, because my world experience, my experience in science will lead me in a very predictable path. And that path is good, but it's not really gonna be at that intersection of different sciences. For example, a very common scenario is I would be in a conversation with a person who's an expert in biophysics, and then another person who's an expert in chemistry, and then someone with a medical background. And all of us know something about a topic, but then our knowledge does not intersect a lot except in that conversation. And from there, I think the best ideas and collaborations are built, to the point that I take pride in this fact that I don't do any project by myself at the IPD. I don't think there is any point in doing a project by yourself, because at the end of the day, when you work with others and you combine different expertise and views to address a problem, you will almost always get the better answer and reach there with a better strategy. So that has been my thing. I don't do projects alone, and this place allows it to be the case.
Let me ask you a related question about that. What's something you really like about what you're doing now? What's your favorite thing about what you do now?
My favorite part about the scientific work that I do is that I have no clue what will happen. This is not an exaggeration. The field of science that I've been focused on involves cell signaling. And we know that cells have molecules that they use to communicate with each other. You can think of these molecules like words. So cells have 50 words, and they communicate 50 different things that they want to say to each other. But what we could do with protein design now is invent new words. What I am doing is basically building new proteins that sends new signals to cells, and we're asking the question of what do cells think about these words. And most of the time, they don't think anything. The cell doesn't respond. It's like, I've never heard this in my life. I don't care. But the really exciting thing is that sometimes these new words mean something to the cell. And you see a cell responding to a word that it's never heard before. And by word, I mean a protein. So you can imagine now I'm in this position where I have this protein that nature has not explored. You put it in front of a cell, the cell responds. And naturally your question is, what does the cell think I'm telling it, right? And that's my everyday, every day I have to ask that question of, okay, like I made this thing that the cell recognizes, but what does it mean? Could it teach us something about the biology of cell communication? And it's just fascinating. We never know what we're going to find out. But even more importantly, being able to talk to cells is not just interesting, it is therapeutically relevant. These molecules, commonly referred to as cytokines or growth factors, have been attempted to be used as therapeutics since we've started doing protein therapies, so long time ago. Surprisingly, most of them, the natural proteins, like cytokines, don't end up being good enough. And the reason is because we cannot really take these proteins and get them to communicate with a specific cell in the specific place at the specific time. When you have these molecules all over your body, that's usually called a cytokine storm, and that's a very bad sign. That means something is wrong with your body. But therapeutically, that's what we do. We just inject these proteins all over and hope that they would do a therapy, which clearly has not been working. What these tools that we're building allow us to do is to take these and get them to do what they were intended for, which is specific communication with specific cells at a particular time. And being able to do that would really open the door for therapies that until now were inaccessible.
All right, I've got a bit of a philosophical question for you. What, in your opinion, makes somebody a good scientist?
So the key to being a good scientist, at least in my opinion, is curiosity. Because you could go and follow protocols in the lab, but eventually you'll get over it. The thing that really gets you going is being curious about the end goal or about the outcome. Usually the people who end up making breakthroughs in terms of how we do research, it starts with a curiosity question of what if I do this instead of the traditional way of doing it. And a lot of times you discover that, well, people do things for a reason and it is the right way to do it. But every so often you will find out that, well, nobody has actually tried to do this before, but it actually makes a lot of sense. That's really where the exciting science happens. And that's why I think if you have a curiosity-driven science that's not restricted into a flow or a pipeline, then you get to discover things that you would not have before.
You obviously seem very smart and you're very accomplished. What is something that you are not good at? Like, not at all?
Well, there is a lot of things. So one of the other things I like involving myself in is singing and sometimes dancing. And if you talk to people who know me, or sometimes people in the lab who stay late enough to see me perform these talents, they will tell you that I'm not the best. But I will tell them that as long as I'm having fun, then I will keep going.
So you're getting better, maybe.
Yes.
I'm curious, do you know the kind of position in science that you might want to do long term? And if so, what is appealing about that to you?
So you would hear this historically when I started my PhD, is that people would say, oh, like, if you are the best scientist, then you will become a professor. That is the end goal of what it means to be successful as a scientist. I think that's very clearly wrong. I think the way that science is structured, as we a lot of us know, is changing very quickly. What position you take is really a matter of what will enable you to achieve the goals that you care about the most. Is your goal to mentor the next generation of scientists? Then being a professor makes a lot of sense. Is your goal to pull a lot of resources and move quickly on a targeted scientific question that might be beneficial to the world? Then maybe you would want to start a company and follow that as fast as possible. So it's the position is really a reflection of what you want to focus on in that stage of your life. I very much enjoy doing open-ended research. I like discovering things. I like playing with things. So naturally, an academic setting presents the best opportunities to do this kind of research. But I am open-minded as to whatever position or place that would allow me the freedom and the space and the funding to explore cool ideas with people from different backgrounds and make breakthroughs together, then I will be there.
So that's Muhammad's science journey, at least so far, from life as a refugee to where he is today, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Washington. I've been lucky to work with and train hundreds of scientists over the years, and I hear journeys like this all the time. And it's really why I wanted to start this podcast, so we could share these stories with others, and so that people everywhere could see there was nothing that could prevent them becoming a scientist if they really wanted to.
Yeah, I think Mohammed's story is really remarkable, but it does speak to the broader truth that there are many ways to get into science, and no two paths are exactly the same. To end this episode, I wanted to go back to the beginning. Mohammed had shared that his life basically had two big chapters so far. His time before immigrating to the US, where science wasn't even in the picture, and his time here as a student and now as a researcher. I asked him to reflect on that and talk about what those two chapters mean to him.
Connecting the past with the current is a very big thing in my life. And actually, so what happened is that I came to the US, and then in the beginning, I did not have a passport, and later financially it didn't make sense, and then grad school and so on. So I really did not get a chance to go back and experience like the culture that I grew up in until this last October. So I was away for about 14 years in the US and never went back. But in October, I went back particularly for this reason, is because I felt like I am a person that is split between two things. And this is a very common immigrant experience where you feel like you don't really belong to any place, but at the same time, you belong to every place. It's a very weird feeling, and it's hard to describe. But there was a lot of these emotions, and I wanted to go somewhere where I felt would be home. So this October, I was in Lebanon. I went to visit my family in the refugee camp, which was in Tripoli. It's called the Badawi refugee camp. That was just a life-changing experience. Despite me knowing everything, I mean, these are my family, I know these places, I've been there a bunch of times, but like, I went there and I saw a bunch of my cousins who are roughly my age, and they were able to get a college degree, but then they have no work opportunities. And that is just basically because of who they were born as a refugee in Lebanon. There's a lot of jobs that are not accessible for you. So you are not allowed to work as a doctor, as an engineer, as a lawyer, anything that is a trade job. You're just not allowed to do it despite having the education. What that means is that, for instance, my cousin who has a degree in computer science, her salary is about $400 a month, which by the standards of the US is ridiculous. Even by Lebanon standards, that's ridiculous. And then that triggers the question of like, is there something really special about me that I get to be here, live this life, be doing really exciting science in a very exciting place when my cousins are like living that very different life? And there is a little bit of survival guilt in there, because I don't think there is anything special about a person who becomes a scientist other than that they are curious and they had the right support network to help them get to where they are. I know that there is nothing special about me. I really hope that we can be in a future where the opportunities that were available to me can be available to more people.
Before we end the interview, I wanted to see if there's anything you want to say about what's happening now between Israel and Gaza.
In October, I was clearly in Lebanon. And I mean, everybody knows that the conflict started again. So the conflict is continuing, at least for Palestinians at this point, for like, we can't even remember since when. And it goes on and off. But that was, and still is, one of the strongest episodes where there is clearly a lot of sadness. There is a lot of people who are losing their lives. And that again gets me to think about what is my position in all of this. And one of the things that as Palestinian American citizen here I experience is that it's a lot of the times not very safe to be very public about my identity, right? And that is a lot of the times when people ask me where you're from, I have to think about, oh, do I actually want to tell them where I'm from? Are they gonna now go and judge that and so on? So it's not a comfortable thing, but that is not only the case for me, it's the case for a lot of Palestinian Americans who live here. So one of the initiatives that I've started since then is I started reaching out to Palestinian American scientists in the US. And we basically are trying to come up with a strategy where we can be more public for the world, or for the US in this case, where when people think about Palestinians, they don't have to think about what they see on the news. So it is true that Palestinians, there is a lot of them who are refugees, there is a lot of them who are struggling, there is a lot of things that are happening that are unpleasant. But we are also just normal people. And there are also a lot of Palestinian scientists out there in the US, out there in the world, who are doing very impactful work that is helping make our world a better place. And I think that aspect of being a human, that aspect of being Palestinian and something that is dissociated from war or conflict needs to be highlighted, because I feel that the world doesn't really see us as just like anyone else. Like we're not trying to be seen as something special. We're just trying to be seen as some like anyone else, that if given the opportunity, they can be very productive members of society. Like that, I think that is the gist of my story, is that if my story would have went in any other direction, if my parents did not send that application and wait 11 years, who knows where I would have been? I would not have been given these opportunities. Like, of course, I will never deny that where I am right now is a direct result of US immigration policy. Despite its all of its imperfections, it gave me an opportunity that I could not have dreamt of. And that changed my life. And I think if others can have similar opportunities, then it can change their life also. And that is one of the things I hope we can accomplish.
Thank you for listening to this first episode of the Baker Lab podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
And I'm David Baker, professor at the University of Washington.
This show was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design in Seattle with help from Susana Vasquez-Torres, Lubitsa Mikhailovic, and Adam Hunt. Our music is by Kevin McLeod. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.